Once the goods were exchanged, they shook hands again, then Vistam bowed to the farmer. Rizin tried to mimic what he did and earned a smile from Thresh and several of his companions. Such a long, boring ride for such a short exchange. But Vistam was right. Those chickens would be worth good spheres in the east.
What did you learn?
That Shin are odd.
No, they are simply different, child. Odd people are those who act erratically. Thresh and his kind, they are anything but erratic. They may be a little too stable. The world is changing outside, but the Shin seem determined to remain the same. I've tried to offer them fabrials, but they find them worthless, or unholy, or too holy to use.
Those are rather different things, Master.
Yes, but with the Shin, it's often hard to distinguish among them. Regardless, what did you really learn?
That they treat being humble like the Herdazians treat boasting. You both went out of your way to show how worthless your wares were. I found it strange, but I think it might just be how they haggle.
And already you are wiser than half the men I've brought here. Listen, here is your lesson. Never try to cheat the Shin. Be forthright. Tell them the truth. And if anything, undervalue your goods. They will love you for it. And they'll pay you for it, too.
She nodded. They reached the wagon, and Vistam got out a strange little pot.
Here, use a knife and go cut out some of that grass. Be sure to cut down far and get plenty of the soil. The plants can't live without it.
Why am I doing this?
Because you're going to learn to care for that plant. I want you to keep it with you until you stop thinking of it as odd.
But why?
Because it will make you a better merchant.
Must he be so strange so much of the time? Perhaps that was why he was one of the only Thalans who could get a good deal out of the Shin.
He is as odd as they are.
She walked off to do as she was told. No use complaining. She did get out a rugged pair of gloves first, though, and roll up her sleeves.
I'm not going to ruin a good dress for a pot of drooling, wolf-staring, imbecile grass. And that is that.
Axes the Collector was lying on his back, skull pounding with a headache. He opened his eyes and looked down the length of his body. He was naked.
Oh, blighted. Oh. Well, best to check and see if I'm hurt too badly.
His toes pointed at the sky. The nails were a deep blue color, not uncommon for an Amian man like himself. He tried to wiggle them, and, pleasingly, they actually moved.
Well, that's something.
He dropped his head back to the ground. It touched something soft.
Likely a bit of rotting garbage.
It smelled pungent and rank.
Ugh. Yes, that's what it is.
He focused on his nose, sculpting his body so that he could no longer smell.
Ah, much better. Now, if I could only banish this pounding in my head. Really, does the sun have to be so garish overhead?
You're still in my alley.
He closed his eyes.
Oh, yes. Well, I shall vacate it presently.
You owe me rent. One night's sleep.
In an alleyway?
Finest alleyway in Khazad-dûm.
Ah, is that where I am then? Excellent.
A few heartbeats of mental focus finally banished the headache. He opened his eyes and this time found the sunlight quite pleasant. Brick walls rose toward the sky on either side of him, overgrown with a crusty red lichen. Small heaps of rotting tubers were scattered around him. No, not scattered. They looked to be arranged carefully.
Oh, that?
They were very likely the source of the scents he'd noticed earlier.
Best to leave my sense of smell inhibited.
He sat up, stretching, checking his muscles. All seemed to be in working order, though he had quite a few bruises. He'd deal with those in a bit.
Now, you wouldn't happen to have a spare pair of pants, would you?
The owner of the voice turned out to be a scraggly bearded man sitting on a box at the end of the alleyway. Axes didn't recognize him, nor did he recognize the location. That wasn't surprising, considering that he'd been beaten, robbed, and left for dead again.
Oh, the things I do in the name of scholarship.
His memory was returning. Kazator was a large Iriali city, second in size only to Ral Elorim. He'd come here by design. He'd also gotten himself drunk by design. Perhaps he should have picked his drinking companions more carefully.
I'm going to guess that you don't have a spare pair of pants. And if you did, I suggest that you wear them yourself. Is that a lavish sack you have on?
You owe me rent and payment for destroying the Temple of the Northern God.
Odd.
Axes looked over his shoulder toward the alleyway's opening. There was a busy street beyond. The good people of Kazator would likely not take well to his nudity.
I don't recall destroying any temples. Normally, I'm quite cognizant of that sort of thing.
You took out half of Hepburn Street, number of homes as well, but I'll let that slide.
Well, that's mighty kind of you.
They've been wicked lately.
Axes frowned, looking back at the beggar. He followed the man's gaze, looking down at the ground. The heaps of rotting vegetables had been placed in a very particular arrangement, like a city. Axes moved his foot, which had been planted on a small square of vegetable.
That was a bakery.
Terribly sorry.
The family was away.
That's a relief.
They were worshipping at the temple.
The one that I...
Smashed with your head, yeah.
Well, I'm certain you'll be kind to their souls.
I'm still trying to decide how you fit into things. Are you a void bringer or a herald?
A void bringer, I'm afraid. I mean, I did destroy a temple.
The beggar's eyes grew more suspicious.
Only the sacred cloth can banish me. Since you don't I say, what is that you're holding?
The beggar looked down at his hand, which was touching one of the ratty blankets draped over one of his equally ratty boxes. He perched atop them like a god looking down over his people.
Oh, poor fool.
It was really time to be moving on.
Wouldn't want to bring any bad luck down upon the addled fellow.
The beggar held up the blanket. Axes shied back, raising his hands. That made the beggar smile a grin that could have used a few more teeth. He hopped off his box, holding the blanket up wardingly.
No! No!
The beggar threw the blanket at him. Axes snatched it from the air and shook a fist at the beggar. Then he retreated from the alleyway while wrapping the blanket around his waist.
And lo, the foul beast was banished!
And lo, the foul beast avoided imprisonment for public indecency!
Iriali were very particular about their chastity laws. They were very particular about a lot of things. Of course, that could be said for most peoples. The only difference were the things they were particular about. Axes the Collector drew his share of stares, not because of his unconventional clothing. Iria was on the northwestern rim of Roshar, and its weather therefore tended to be much warmer than that of places like Alethkar or even Aesir. A fair number of the golden-haired Iriali men went about wearing only waist wraps, their skin painted various colors and patterns. Even Axes's tattoos weren't that noteworthy here. Perhaps he drew stares because of his blue nails and crystalline deep blue eyes. Amians, even Saya Amians, were rare. Or perhaps it was because he cast a shadow the wrong way, toward light instead of away from it. It was a small thing, and the shadows weren't long with the sun so high, but those who noticed muttered or jumped out of the way. Likely they'd heard of his kind. It hadn't been that long since the scouring of his homeland. Just long ago enough for stories and legends to have crept into the general knowledge of most peoples. Perhaps someone important would take exception to him and have him brought before a local magistrate. Wouldn't be the first time. He'd learned long ago not to worry. When the curse of kind followed you, you learned to take what happened as it happened. He began inspecting his tattoos and ignoring those observant enough to gawk.
I remember writing something somewhere.
He looked over his wrist, then twisted his arm over and tried to see if there were any new tattoos on the back. Like all Amians, He could change the color and markings of his skin at will. That was convenient, as when you were very regularly robbed of everything you owned, it was blighted difficult to keep a proper notebook. And so he kept his notes on his skin, at least until he could return to a safe location and transcribe them. Hopefully, he hadn't gotten so drunk that he'd written his observations someplace inconvenient. He'd done that once, and reading the mess had required two mirrors and a very confused bathing attendant. He discovered a new entry near the inside of his left elbow. He read it awkwardly, shuffling down the incline.
Test successful. Have noted Spren, who appear only when one is severely intoxicated. Appear as small brown bubbles clinging to objects nearby. Further testing may be needed to prove that they were more than a drunken hallucination. Very nice indeed. I wonder what I should call them.
The stories he'd heard called them Sudspren, but that seems silly.
Intoxication Spren. No, that's too unwieldy. Ale Spren!
He'd been hunting this particular type of Spren for years. If they proved real, it would be quite a victory.
Why do they only appear in Eerie? And why so infrequently?
He'd gotten himself stupidly drunk a dozen times and had only found them once. If, indeed, he had ever really found them. Spren, however, could be very elusive. Sometimes, even the most common types, Flame Spren, for instance, would refuse to appear. That made it particularly frustrating for a man who had made it his life's work to observe, catalog, and study every single type of Spren in Roshar. He made his way through the town to the dockside. Around him flowed large numbers of the golden-haired Iriali. Their hair bred true like black Alethi hair. The purer your blood was, the more locks of gold you had. And it wasn't merely blonde, it was truly gold. Lustrous in the sun. He had a fondness for the Iriali. They weren't nearly as prudish as the Vorin peoples to the east and were rarely inclined to bickering or fighting. That made it easier to hunt Spren. Of course, there were also Spren you could find only during war. A group of people had gathered at the docks.
Ah, excellent. I'm not too late.
Most were crowding onto a purpose-built viewing platform. Axes found himself a place to stand, adjusted his holy blanket, and leaned back against the railing to wait. It wasn't long. At precisely 7:46 in the morning, the locals could use it to set their timepieces. An enormous, sea-blue Spren surged from the waters of the bay. It was translucent, and though it appeared to throw out waves as it rose, that was illusory. The actual surface of the bay wasn't disturbed.
It takes the shape of a large jet of water.
Axes created a tattoo along an open portion of his leg, scribing the words.
The center is the deepest blue like the ocean depths, though the outer edges are a lighter shade. Judging by the mast of the nearby ships, I'd say that the Spren has grown to a height of at least 100 feet. One of the largest I've ever seen.
The column sprouted four long arms that came down around the bay, forming fingers and thumbs. They landed on golden pedestals that had been placed there by the people of the city. The Spren came at the same time every day, without fail.
Kusakesh the Protector.
That's what they called it. Some worshipped it as a god, some simply accepted it as part of the city. It was unique. One of the few types of Spren he knew of that seemed to have only a single member.
But what kind of Spren is it?
Axes was fascinated. It had formed a face, looking eastward, directly toward the origin.
The face is shifting bewilderingly quick. Different human faces appear on the end of its stump-like neck, one after another in blurred succession.
The display lasted a full 10 minutes.
Did any of the faces repeat?
They changed so quickly, he couldn't tell. Some seemed male, others female. Once the display was finished, Kusakesh retreated down into the bay, sending up phantom waves again. Axes felt drained, as if something had been leached from him. That was reported to be a common reaction.
Am I imagining it because I expect it, or is it real?
A street urchin scrambled past and grabbed his wrap, yanking it free.
What a bother. There are guards nearby, I assume. Oh, yes, four of them. Wonderful.
The four were already stalking toward him, golden hair falling around their shoulders, expression stern.
Well, it appears I'll have another chance to search for captivity, Spren.
Odd how those had eluded him all these years, despite his numerous incarcerations. He was beginning to consider them mythological. The guards towed him off toward the city dungeons.
2 new Spren in as many days. At this rate, it might only take a few more centuries to complete my research. Grand indeed!
Zeth Sun Valano, Truthless of Shinovar, crouched on a high stone ledge at the side of the gambling den. The ledge was meant for holding a lantern. Both his legs and the shelf were hidden by his long, enveloping cloak, making him seem to be hanging from the wall. There were few lights nearby. Makik liked Zeth to remain cloaked in shadow. He wore a form-fitting black costume beneath the cloak, the lower part of his face covered by a cloth mask. Both were of Makik's design. The cloak was too big and the clothing too tight. It was a terrible outfit for an assassin, but Makik demanded drama, and Zeth did as his master commanded, always. Perhaps there was something useful to the drama. With only his eyes and bald head showing, he unnerved the people who passed by. Shin eyes, too round, slightly too large. The people here thought them similar to the eyes of a child.
Why does that disturb them so?
Nearby, a group of men in brown cloaks sat chatting and rubbing their thumbs and forefingers together. Wisps of smoke rose between their fingers. Rubbing fire moss was said to make a man's mind more receptive to thoughts and ideas. The one time Zeth had tried it, it had given him a headache and 2 blistered fingers. But once you grew the calluses, it could, apparently, be euphoric. The circular den had a bar at the center, serving a wide variety of drinks at a wider variety of prices. The barmaids were dressed in violet robes that had plunging necklines and were open at the sides. Their safe hands were exposed, something the Bavlanders, who were Voren by descent, seemed to find extremely provocative. So odd. It was just a hand. Around the perimeter of the den, various games were in progress. None of them were overt games of chance, no dice throws, no bets on card flips. There were games of breakneck, shallow crab fights, and, oddly, guessing games. That was another oddity about Voren peoples. They avoided overtly guessing the future. A game like breakneck would have throws and tosses, but they wouldn't bet on the outcome. Instead, they'd bet on the hand they held after the throws and the draws. It seemed a meaningless distinction to Zeth, but it was deeply steeped in the culture. Even here, in one of the vilest pits in the city, where women walked with their hands exposed and men spoke openly of crimes, nobody risked offending the heralds by seeking to know the future. Even predicting the high storms made many uncomfortable, and yet they thought nothing of walking on stone or using stormlight for everyday illumination. They ignored the spirits of things that lived around them, and they ate whatever they wanted on any day they wanted.
Strange. So strange.
And yet, this was his life. Recently, Zeth had begun to question some of the prohibitions he had once followed so strictly.
How can these Easterners not walk on stone? There is no soil in their lands. How can they get about without treading on stone?
Dangerous thoughts. His way of life was all that remained to him. If he questioned stone shamanism, would he then question his nature as truthless?
Dangerous. Dangerous.
Though his murders and sins would damn him, at least his soul would be given to the stones upon his death. He would continue to exist, punished, in agony, but not exiled to nothingness. Better to exist in agony than to vanish entirely. Makik himself strode the floor of the gambling den, a woman on each arm. His scrawny leanness was gone, his face having slowly gained a juicy plumpness, like a fruit ripening after the drowning's waters. Also gone were his ragged footpads garments, replaced with luxurious silks. Mekik's companions, the ones with him when they'd killed Took, were all dead, murdered by Zeth at Mekik's orders, all to hide the secret of the Oathstone. Why were these Easterners always so ashamed of the way they controlled Zeth? Was it because they feared another would steal the Oathstone from them? Were they terrified that the weapon they employed so callously would be turned against them? Perhaps he feared that if it were known how easily Zeth was controlled, it would spoil their reputation. Seth had overheard more than one conversation centered around the mystery of Mekik's terribly effective bodyguard. If a creature like Zeth served Mekik, then the master himself must be even more dangerous. Mekik passed the place where Zeth lurked. He glanced at Zeth, then gestured curtly. Zeth bowed his masked head in acknowledgement. He slid from his place, dropping to the ground, oversized cloak fluttering. Men both drunken and sober watched Zeth, and as he passed the three men with the fire moss, their fingers went limp. Most of the room knew what Zeth was about this night. A man had moved into Bornwater and opened his own gambling den to challenge Mekik. Likely, this newcomer didn't believe the reputation of Mekik's phantom assassin. Well, he had reason to be skeptical. Seth's reputation was inaccurate. He was far, far more dangerous than it suggested. He ducked out of the gambling den, passing up the steps through the darkened storefront, and then out into the yard. He tossed the cloak and face mask into a wagon as he passed. The cloak would only make noise, and why cover his face? He was the only Shin in town. If someone saw his eyes, they'd know who he was. He retained the tight black clothing. Changing would take too much time. Bornwater was the largest town in the area. It hadn't taken Mekik long to outgrow Stapland. Now he was talking of moving up to Kneespike, the city where the local landlord had his mansion. If that happened, Zeth would spend months wading in blood as he systematically tracked down and killed each and every thief, cutthroat, and gambling master who refused Mekik's rule. That was months off now. For now, there was Bornwater's interloper, a man named Gavishaw. Zeth prowled through the streets, eschewing Stormlight or Shardblade, counting on his natural grace and care to keep him unseen. He enjoyed his brief freedom. These moments, when he wasn't trapped in one of Mekik's smoke-filled dens, were too few lately. Slipping between buildings, moving swiftly in the darkness with the wet, cold air on his skin, he could almost think himself back in Shinnabar. The buildings around him were not of blasphemous stone, but earthen ones, built with clay and soil. But no, in Shinnabar, he'd never smelled refuse like that, pungency compounded by weeks spent marinating. He was not home. There was no place for him in the Valley of Truth. Seth entered one of the richer sections of town, where buildings had more space between homes. Bornwater was in a late, protected by a towering cliffside to the east. Gavishaw had arrogantly made his home in a large mansion on the eastern side of town. It belonged to the provincial landlord. Gavishaw had his favor. The landlord had heard of Mekik and his quick rise to prominence in the underground, and supporting a rival was a good way to create an early check on Mekik's power. The city lord's local mansion was three stories tall, with a stone wall surrounding the compact, neatly gardened grounds. Zeth approached in a low crouch. He reached the wall and pressed himself against it. It was the time between the first two moons, the darkest period of the night. The hateful hour, his people called it, for it was one of the only times when the gods did not watch men. Soldiers walked the wall above. Gavishaw probably thought himself safe in this building, which was secure enough for a powerful light eyes. Seth infused himself with stormlight from the spheres in his pouch. He began to glow, luminescent vapors rising from his skin. In the darkness, it was quite noticeable. These powers had never been intended for assassination. Surgebinders had fought during the light of day, battling the night, but not embracing it. This was not Zeth's place. He would simply have to take extra care not to be seen. 10 heartbeats after the passing of the guards, Zeth lashed himself to the wall. That direction became down for him, and he was able to run up the side of the stone fortification. As he reached the top, he leaped forward, then briefly lashed himself backward. He spun over the top of the wall in a tucked flip, then lashed himself back to the wall again. He came down with feet planted on the stones facing the ground. He ran and lashed himself downward again, dropping the last few feet. The grounds were laced with shale bark mounds, cultivated to form small terraces. Zeth ducked low, picking his way through the maze-like garden. There were guards at the building's doorways, watching by the light of spheres. How easy it would be to dash up, consume the stormlight, and plunge the men into darkness before cutting them down. But Makik had not expressly commanded him to be so destructive. Gavishaw was to be assassinated, but the method was up to Zeth. He picked one that would not require killing the guards. That was what he always did when given the chance. It was the only way to preserve what little humanity he had left. He reached the western wall of the mansion and lashed himself to it, then ran up onto the roof. It was long and flat, sloped gently eastward. An unnecessary feature in a late, but Easterners saw the world by the light of the high storms. Zeth quickly crossed to the rear of the building, to where a small rock dome covered a lower portion of the mansion. He dropped down onto the dome, stormlight streaming from his body. Translucent, luminescent, pristine, like the ghost of a fire burning from him, consuming his soul. He summoned his shard blade in the stillness and dark, then used it to slice a hole in the dome, angling his blade so that the chunk of rock did not fall down inside. He reached down with his free hand and infused the stone circle with light, lashing it toward the northwest section of the sky. Lashing something to a distant point like that was possible, but imprecise. It was like trying to shoot an arrow a great distance. He stepped back as the stone circle lurched free and fell up into the air, streaming stormlight as it soared toward the splattered paint drops of stars above. Zeth leaped into the hole, then immediately lashed himself to the ceiling. He twisted in the air, landing with his feet planted on the underside of the dome beside the lip of the hole he'd cut. From his perspective, he was now standing at the bottom of a gigantic stone bowl, the hole cut in the very bottom, looking out on the stars beneath. He walked up the side of the bowl, lashing himself to the right. In seconds, he was on the floor, reoriented so that the dome rose above him. The sound was the chunk of stone which, stormlight exhausted, had fallen back to the ground. He had aimed it out of the town. Hopefully, it had not caused any accidental deaths. The guards would now be distracted, searching for the source of the distant crash. Zeth drained his second pouch of gemstones. The light streaming from him became brighter, letting him see the room around him. As he'd suspected, it was empty. This was a rarely used feasting hall, with cold fire pits, tables, and benches. Zeth hurried to the door, slid his shard blade between it and the frame, and sliced through the deadbolt. The stormlight rising from his body illuminated the dark hallway outside. Early during his time with Makik, Zeth had been careful not to use the shard blade. As his tasks had grown more difficult, however, he'd been forced to resort to it to avoid unnecessary killing. Now the rumors about him were populated with tales of holes cut through stone and dead men with burned eyes. Makik had begun to believe those rumors. He hadn't yet demanded that Zeth relinquish the blade. If he did so, he would discover the second of Zeth's two forbidden actions. He was required to carry the blade until his death, after which Shin Stone Shamans would recover it from whomever had killed him. He moved through the hallways. He wasn't worried about Makik taking the blade, but he was worried about how bold the Thief Lord was growing. The more successful Zeth was, the more audacious Makik became. How long before he stopped using Zeth to kill minor rivals, instead sending him to kill shard bearers or powerful light eyes? How long before someone made the connection? A Shin assassin with a shard blade, capable of mysterious feats and extreme stealth. Could this be the now infamous assassin in white? Makik could draw the Alethi king and high princes away from their war on the shattered plains and bring them crashing down upon Nyar-Kaved. Thousands would die. Blood would fall like the rain of a high storm, thick, pervasive, destructive. He continued down the hallway in a swift, low run, shard blade carried in a reverse grip, extending out behind him.
Tonight, at least, I'm assassinating a man who deserves his fate.
Seth hadn't seen a soul since leaving the rooftop. Could Gavishaw have been foolish enough to place all of his guards outside, leaving his bedchamber undefended? Ahead, the doors into the master's rooms lay unwatched and dark at the end of a short hallway.
Suspicious.
Seth crept up to the doors, listening. He hesitated, glancing to the sides. A grand stairway led up to the second floor. He hustled over and used his blade to shear free a wooden knob from the nearest mule post. It was about the size of a small melon. A few hacks with the blade cut a cloak-sized section of drapery free from a window. Seth hurried back to the doors and infused the wooden sphere with stormlight, giving it a basic lashing that pointed it westward, directly ahead of him. He cut through the latch between the doors and eased one open. The room beyond was dark. Was Gavishaw gone for the evening? Where would he go? The city was not safe for him yet. Seth placed the wooden ball in the middle of the drape, then held it up and dropped it. It fell forward toward the far wall. Wrapped in fabric, the ball looked vaguely like a person in a cloak running through the room in a crouch. No concealed guard struck at it. The decoy bounced off a latched window, then came to rest hanging against the wall. It continued to leak stormlight. That light illuminated a small table with an object atop it. Seth squinted, trying to make out what it was. He edged forward, slinking into the room, closer and closer to the table.
Yes.
The object on the table was a head. One with Gavishaw's features. Shadows thrown by stormlight gave the grisly face an even more haunted cast. Someone had beaten Zeth to the assassination.
Zeth San Nuturo.
Seth turned, spinning his shard blade around and falling into a defensive stance. A figure stood on the far side of the room, shrouded in darkness.
Who are you?
Are you satisfied with this, Zeth San Nuturo? Are you satisfied with trivial crimes? Killing over meaningless turf and backwater mining villages?
Seth scanned the room, looking for motion in the other shadows. None seemed to be hiding anyone.
I've watched you. You've been sent to intimidate shopkeepers. You've killed footpads so unimportant even the authorities ignore them. You've been shown off to impress whores, as if they were high, light-eyed ladies. What a waste.
I do as my master demands.
You are squandered. You are not meant for petty extortions and murders. Using you like this, it's like hitching a Rashadium stallion to a rundown market wagon. It's like using a shard blade to slice vegetables, or like using the finest parchment as kindling for washwater fire. It is a crime. You are a work of art, Zeth San Nuturo, a god, and each day Makik throws dung at you.
Who are you?
An admirer of the arts.
Do not call me by my father's name. He should not be sullied by association with me.
The sphere on the wall finally ran out of stormlight, dropping to the floor.
Very well. But do you not rebel against this frivolous use of your skills? Were you not meant for greatness?
There is no greatness in killing. You speak like a Kukori. Great men create food and clothing. He who adds is to be revered. I am he who takes away. At least in the killing of men such as these, I can pretend to be doing a service.
This from the man who nearly toppled one of the greatest kingdoms in Roshar.
This from the man who committed one of the most heinous slaughters in Roshar.
What you did was a mere breeze compared to the storm of slaughter shardbearers wreak on a battlefield each day. And those are breezes compared to the tempest you are capable of.
Seth began to walk away.
Where are you going?
Gavishaw is dead. I must return to my master.
The figure dropped something round and heavy. It rolled across the floor toward Zeth. Another head. It came to rest on its side. Zeth froze as he made out the features. The pudgy cheeks were stained with blood, the dead eyes wide with shock.
Makek? How?
We took him seconds after you left the gambling den.
We?
Servants of your new master.
My oathstone?
The figure opened his hand, revealing a gemstone suspended in his palm by a chain wrapped around his fingers. Sitting beside it, now illuminated, was Zeth's oathstone. The figure's face was dark. He wore a mask. Zeth dismissed his shard blade and went down on one knee.
What are your orders?
There is a list on the table. It details our master's wishes.
Zeth rose and walked over. Beside the head, which rested on a plate to contain the blood, was a sheet of paper. He took it, and his stormlight illuminated some 24 names written in the warrior script of his homeland. Some had a note beside them with instructions on how they were to be killed.
Glories within. These are some of the most powerful people in the world. 6 high princes? A Sileg Gerontark? The king of Yakavet?
It is time you stopped wasting your talent.
This will cause chaos, infighting, war, confusion and pain such as the world has rarely known.
The chained gemstone on the man's palm flashed. The wall vanished, turning to smoke.
A soul caster.
Indeed. Our master directs that you are to use tactics similar to those you employed so well in Alethkar years ago. When you are done, you will receive further instructions.
He then exited through the opening, leaving Zeth horrified. This was his nightmare. To be in the hands of those who understood his capabilities and who had the ambition to use them properly. He stood for a time, silent, long past when his stormlight ran out. Then, reverently, he folded the list. He was surprised that his hands were so steady. He should be trembling, for soon the world itself would shake.
The ones of ash and fire who killed like a swarm, relentless before the heralds. Noted in Masley, page 337. Corroborated by Caldwin and Hassava.
It sounds like you're getting into Yasna's good graces quickly. How long before you can make the switch?
The span reed stopped. Shallan grimaced, turning the gemstone on the reed.
I don't know. Yasna keeps a close watch on the Soulcaster, as you'd expect. She wears it all day. At night, she locks it away in her safe and wears the key around her neck.
She turned the gemstone, then waited for a reply. She was in her chamber, a small stone-carved room inside Yasna's quarters. Her accommodations were austere. A small bed, a nightstand, and the writing table were her only furniture. Her clothing remained in the trunk she had brought. No rug adorned the floor, and there were no windows, as the rooms were in the Carbranthian conclave, which was underground.
That does make it troubling.
Elita, Nanbalat's betrothed, was the one doing the writing, but all 3 of Shallan's surviving brothers would be in the room back in Yakaved, contributing to the conversation.
I'm guessing she takes it off while bathing. Once she trusts me more, she may begin using me as a bathing attendant. That may present an opportunity.
That is a good plan. Nanbalat wants me to point out that we are very sorry to make you do this. It must be difficult for you to be away so long.
Difficult?
Shallan picked up the span reed and hesitated. Yes, it was difficult. Difficult not to fall in love with the freedom. Difficult not to get too absorbed in her studies. It had been only 2 months since she'd convinced Yasna to take her as a ward, but already she felt half as timid and twice as confident. The most difficult thing of all was knowing that it would soon end. Coming to study in Carbranth was, without doubt, the most wonderful thing that had ever happened to her.
I will manage. You are the ones living the difficult life, maintaining our family's interests at home. How are you doing?
It took time for them to reply.
Your father's debts are coming due, and Wickham can barely keep the creditors distracted. The High Prince ails, and everyone wants to know where our house stands on the question of succession. The last of the quarries is running out. If it becomes known that we no longer have resources, it will go badly for us.
How long do I have?
A few more months, at best. It depends on how long the High Prince lasts and whether or not anyone realizes why Asha Jushu is selling our possessions.
Jushu was the youngest of the brothers, just older than Shallan. His old gambling habit was actually coming in handy. For years, he'd been stealing things from their father and selling them to cover his losses. He pretended he was still doing that, but he brought the money back to help. He was a good man, despite his habit. And, all things considered, he really couldn't be blamed for much of what he'd done. None of them could.
Wickham thinks that he can keep everyone at bay for a while longer, but we are getting desperate. The sooner you return with the Soulcaster, the better.
Are we certain this is the best way? Perhaps we should simply ask Yasna for help.
You think she would respond to that? She would help an unknown and a disliked Vaden house? She would keep our secrets?
Probably not.
Though Shallan was increasingly certain that Yasna's reputation was exaggerated, the woman did have a ruthless side to her. She would not leave her important studies to go help Shallan's family. She reached for the reed to reply, but it started scribbling again.
Shallan, this is Nan Balat. I have sent the others away. It is only Elita and me writing you now. There is something you need to know. Luesh is dead.
Shallan blinked in surprise. Luesh, her father's steward, had been the one who had known how to use the Soulcaster. He was one of the few people she and her brothers had determined they could trust.
What happened?
He died in his sleep, and there's no reason to suspect he was killed. But Shallan, a few weeks after his passing, some men visited here claiming to be friends of our father. In private with me, they implied they knew of Father's Soulcaster and suggested strongly that I was to return it to them.
Shallan frowned. She still carried her father's broken Soulcaster in the safe pouch of her sleeve.
Return it?
We never did figure out where Father got it. Shallan, he was involved in something. Those maps, the things Luesh said, and now this. We continue to pretend that Father is alive, and occasionally he gets letters from other Light Eyes that speak of vague plans. I think he was going to make a play to become High Prince, and he was supported by some very powerful forces. These men who came, they were dangerous, Shallan. The type of men you do not cross. And they want their Soulcaster back. Whoever they are, I suspect they gave it to Father so he could create wealth and make a bid for the succession. They know he's dead. I believe that if we don't return a working Soulcaster to them, we could all be in serious danger. You need to bring Yasna's Fabriel to us. We'll quickly use it to create new quarries of valuable stone, and then we can give it up to these men. Shallan, you must succeed. I was hesitant about this plan when you suggested it, but other avenues are quickly vanishing.
Shallan felt a chill. She read over the paragraphs a few times.
If Luesh is dead, then we don't know how to use the Soulcaster. That is problematic.
I know. See if you can figure that out. This is dangerous, Shallan. I know it is. I'm sorry.
It must be done.
Here, I wanted to show you something. Have you ever seen this symbol?
The sketch that followed was crude. Elita wasn't much of an artist. Fortunately, it was a simple picture. Three diamond shapes in a curious pattern.
I've never seen it. Why?
Luesh wore a pendant with this symbol on it. We found it on his body. And one of the men who came searching for the Soulcaster had the pattern tattooed on his hand, just below his thumb.
Curious. So, Luesh...
Yes. Despite what he said, I think he must have been the one who brought the Soulcaster to Father. Luesh was involved in this, perhaps a liaison between Father and the people backing him. I tried to suggest that they could back me instead, but the men just laughed. They did not stay long or give a specific time by which the Soulcaster must be returned. I doubt they'd be satisfied to receive a broken one.
Balat, have you thought that we might be risking a war? If it becomes known that we've stolen an Alethi Soulcaster...
No, there wouldn't be a war. King Hanavenar would just turn us over to the Alethi. They'd execute us for the theft.
Wonderfully comforting, Belat. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. We're going to have to hope that Yasna doesn't realize that you took the Soulcaster. It seems likely she'll assume that hers broke for some reason.
Perhaps.
Take care.
You too.
And that was it. She set the span read aside, then read over the entire conversation, memorizing it. Then she crumpled up the sheets and walked into the sitting room of Yasna's quarters. She wasn't there. Yasna rarely broke from her studies, so Shallan burned the conversation in the hearth. She stood for a long moment watching the fire. She was worried. Nan Balat was capable, but they all bore scars from the lives they'd led. Elita was the only scribe they could trust, and she, well, she was incredibly nice, but not very clever. Shallan left the room to return to her studies. Not only would they help her get her mind off her troubles, but Yasna would grow testy if she dallied too long. 5 hours later, Shallan wondered why it was she'd been so eager. She did enjoy her chances at scholarship, but recently Yasna had set her to study the history of the Alethi monarchy. It wasn't the most interesting subject around. Her boredom was compounded by her being forced to read a number of books that expressed opinions she found ridiculous. She sat in Yasna's alcove at the Vale. The enormous wall of lights, alcoves, and mysterious researchers no longer awed her. The place was becoming comfortable and familiar. She was alone at the moment. Shallan rubbed her eyes with her free hand, then slid her book closed.
I am really coming to hate the Alethi monarchy.
Is that so?
Yasna walked past, wearing a sleek violet dress, followed by a parchment porter with a stack of books.
I'll try not to take it personally.
I didn't mean individually, Brightness Yasna. I meant categorically.
Yasna lithely took her seat in the alcove. She raised an eyebrow at Shallan, then gestured for the parchman to set down his burden. He did so and withdrew. Shallan still found Yasna an enigma. At times, she seemed a stern scholar annoyed by Shallan's interruptions. At other times, there seemed to be a hint of wry humor hiding behind the stern facade. Either way, Shallan was finding that she felt remarkably comfortable around the woman. Yasna encouraged her to speak her mind, something Shallan had taken to gladly.
I assume from your outburst that this topic is wearing on you. You expressed interest in being a scholar. Well, you must learn that this is scholarship.
Reading argument after argument from people who refuse to see any other point of view?
They're confident.
I'm not an expert on confidence, Brightness, but I'd like to think that I could recognize it if it were before me. I don't think that's the right word for books like this one from Madaria. They feel more arrogant than confident to me. To be honest, arrogant doesn't feel like quite the right word. It's not specific enough.
And what would be the right word, then?
I don't know. Arrogant, with the opening letters E-R-R, perhaps.
Yasna raised a skeptical eyebrow.
It means to be twice as certain as someone who is merely arrogant, while possessing only one-tenth the requisite facts.
What you are reacting against is known as the assuredness movement, Shallan. This arrogance is a literary device. The scholars are intentionally overstating their case.
The assuredness movement?
Shallan held up one of her books.
I guess I could get behind that.
Oh?
Yes. Much easier to stab it in the back from that position. I suppose I can understand the device, Brightness, but these books you've given me on King Gavilar's death are more and more irrational in defending their points. What began as a rhetorical conceit seems to have descended into name-calling and squabbling.
They're trying to provoke discussion. Would you rather that the scholars hide from the truth, like so many? You would have men prefer ignorance?
When reading these books, scholarship and ignorance feel much alike to me. Ignorance may reside in a man hiding from intelligence, but scholarship can seem ignorance hidden behind intelligence.
And what of intelligence without ignorance?
finding truth while not dismissing the possibility of being wrong.
A mythological treasure, Brightness, much like the Dawn Shards or the Honor Blades. Certainly worth seeking, but only with great caution.
Caution?
It would make you famous, but actually finding it would destroy us all. Proof that one can be both intelligent and accept the intelligence of those who disagree with you? Why, I should certainly think it would undermine the scholarly world in its entirety.
You go too far, child. If you took half the energy you devote to being witty and channeled it into your work, I dare say you could be one of the greatest scholars of our age.
I'm sorry, Brightness. I'm confused. Considering the gaps in my education, I assumed you would have me studying things deeper in the past than a few years ago.
I have found that youths like you have a relative lack of appreciation for the distant past. Therefore, I selected an area of study that is both more recent and sensational, to ease you into true scholarship. Is the murder of a king not of interest to you?
Yes, Brightness. We children love things that are shiny and loud.
You have quite the mouth on you at times.
At times? You mean it's not there at others? I'll have to... Sorry.
Never apologize for being clever, Shallan. It sets a bad precedent. However, one must apply one's wit with care. You often seem to say the first passably clever thing that enters your mind.
I know. It's long been a foible of mine, Brightness. One my nurses and tutors tried very hard to discourage.
Likely through strict punishments.
Yes. Making me sit in the corner holding books over my head was the preferred method.
Which, in turn, only trained you to make your quips more quickly, for you knew you had to get them out before you could reconsider and suppress them. The punishments were incompetent. Used upon one such as yourself, they were actually encouragement. A game. How much would you have to say to earn a punishment? Could you say something so clever that your tutors missed the joke? Sitting in the corner just gave you more time to compose retorts.
But it's unseemly for a young woman to speak as I so often do.
The only unseemly thing is to not channel your intelligence usefully. Consider, you have trained yourself to do something very similar to what annoys you in the scholars. Cleverness without thought behind it. Intelligence, one might say, without a foundation of proper consideration. Arrogant, wouldn't you say?
Shallan blushed.
I prefer my wards to be clever. It gives me more to work with. I should bring you to court with me. I suspect that wit, at least, would find you amusing, if only because your apparent natural timidity and your clever tongue make such an intriguing combination.
Yes, Brightness.
Please. Just remember that a woman's mind is her most precious weapon. It must not be employed clumsily or prematurely. Much like the aforementioned knife to the back, a clever jibe is most effective when it is unanticipated.
I'm sorry, Brightness.
It wasn't an admonition, simply an observation. I make them on occasion. Those books are musty. The sky is blue today. My ward is a smart-lipped reprobate. Now, tell me what you've discovered.
Not much, Brightness. Or should I say too much? Each writer has her own theories on why the Parshendi killed your father. Some claim he must have insulted them at the feast that night. Others say that the entire treaty was a ruse, intending to get the Parshendi close to him. But it makes little sense, as they had much better opportunities earlier.
And the assassin in white?
A true anomaly. The undertexts are filled with commentary about him. Why would the Parshendi hire an outside assassin? Did they fear they could not accomplish the job themselves? Or perhaps they didn't hire him and were framed. Many think that is unlikely, considering that the Parshendi took credit for the murder.
And your thoughts?
I feel inadequate to draw conclusions, Brightness.
What is the point of research if not to draw conclusions?
My tutors told me that supposition was only for the very experienced.
Your tutors were idiots. Youthful immaturity is one of the Cosmere's great catalysts for change, Shallan. Do you realize that the Sunmaker was only 17 when he began his conquest? Guevara hadn't reached her 20th weeping when she proposed the theory of the three realms.
But for every Sunmaker or Guevara, are there not 100 Gregors?
Gregor had been a youthful king notorious for beginning a pointless war with kingdoms that had been his father's allies.
There was only one Gregor, thankfully. Your point is a valid one. Hence the purpose of education. To be young is about action. To be a scholar is about informed action.
Or about sitting in an alcove reading about a 5-year-old murder.
I would not have you studying this if there were no point to it. Too many scholars think of research as purely a cerebral pursuit. If we do nothing with the knowledge we gain, then we have wasted our study. Books can store information better than we can. What we do that books cannot is interpret. So, if one is not going to draw conclusions, then one might as well just leave the information in the texts.
Shallan sat back thoughtful. Presented that way, it somehow made her want to dig back into the studies. What was it that Jasnah wanted her to do with the information? Once again, she felt a stab of guilt. Jasnah was taking great pains to instruct her in scholarship, and she was going to reward the woman by stealing her most valuable possession and leaving a broken replacement. It made Shallan feel sick. She had expected study beneath Jasnah to involve meaningless memorization and busy work, accompanied by chastisement for not being smart enough. That was how her tutors had approached her instruction. Jasnah was different. She gave Shallan a topic and the freedom to pursue it as she wished. Jasnah offered encouragement and speculation, but nearly all of their conversations turned to topics like the true nature of scholarship, the purpose of studying, the beauty of knowledge, and its application. Jasnah Kolin truly loved learning, and she wanted others to as well. Behind the stern gaze, intense eyes, and rarely smiling lips, Jasnah Kolin truly believed in what she was doing, whatever that was. Shallan raised one of her books, but covertly eyed the spines of Jasnah's latest stack of tomes. More histories about the heraldic epics, mythologies, commentaries, books by scholars known to be wild speculators. Jasnah's current volume was called Shadows Remembered. Shallan memorized the title. She would try to find a copy and look through it. What was Jasnah pursuing? What secrets was she hoping to pry from these volumes, most of them centuries-old copies of copies? Though Shallan had discovered some secrets regarding the Soulcaster, the nature of Jasnah's quest, the reason the princess had come to Carbranth, remained elusive. Maddeningly, yet tantalizingly so. Jasnah liked to speak of the great women of the past, ones who had not just recorded history, but shaped it. Whatever it was she studied, she felt that it was important, world-changing.
You mustn't be drawn in. Your goal is not to change the world. Your goal is to protect your brothers and your house.
Still, she needed to make a good show of her wardship, and that gave her reason to immerse herself for 2 hours until footsteps in the hallway interrupted. Likely the servants bringing the midday meal. Jasnah and Shallan often ate on their balcony. Shallan's stomach grumbled as she smelled the food, and she gleefully set aside her book. She usually sketched at lunch, an activity that Jasnah, despite her dislike of the visual arts, encouraged. She said that high-born men often thought drawing and painting to be enticing in a woman, and so Shallan should maintain her skills, if only for the purpose of attracting suitors. Shallan didn't know whether to find that insulting or not. And what did it say about Jasnah's own intentions for marriage that she herself never bothered with the more becoming feminine arts like music or drawing?
Your Majesty!
Shallan looked hastily over her shoulder. The elderly king of Carbranth was standing in the doorway, wearing magnificent orange and white robes with detailed embroidery. Shallan scrambled to her feet.
Brightness Jasnah, am I interrupting?
Your company is never an interruption, Your Majesty. We were soon to take lunch, anyway.
I know, Brightness. I hope you don't mind if I join you.
A group of servants began bringing in food and a table.
Not at all.
The servants hurried to set things up, putting two different tablecloths on the round table to separate the genders during dining. They secured the half-moons of cloth, red for the king, blue for the women, with weights at the center. Covered plates filled with food followed, a clear stew with sweet vegetables for the women, a spicy-smelling broth for the king. Carbranthians preferred soups for their lunches. Shallan was surprised to see them set a place for her. Her father had never eaten at the same table as his children. Even she, his favorite, had been relegated to her own table. Once Yasna sat, Shallan did likewise. The king waved for them to begin. His motion seemed ungainly compared with Yasna's elegance. Shallan was soon eating contentedly, with grace, as a woman should, safe hand in her lap, using her free hand and a skewer to spear chunks of vegetable or fruit.
And how is your granddaughter, Your Majesty? She is recovering well?
Oh, quite well, thank you. Though she now avoids the narrower corridors of the conclave, I do want to thank you for your aid.
It is always fulfilling to be of service, Your Majesty.
If you will forgive my saying so, the Ardens do not think much of your service. I realize it is likely a sensitive topic. Perhaps I shouldn't mention it, but...
No, feel free. I'm not ashamed of my choices.
Then you'll forgive an old man's curiosity.
I always forgive curiosity, Your Majesty. It strikes me as one of the most genuine of emotions.
Then where did you find it? How did you keep it from the devotaries?
One might find those questions dangerous, Your Majesty.
I've already acquired some new enemies by welcoming you.
You will be forgiven. Depending on the devotary you have chosen.
Forgiven? Me? Unlikely. But that is something else entirely. Please, I stand by my questions.
And I stand by my evasiveness, Your Majesty. I'm sorry. I do forgive your curiosity, but I cannot reward it. These secrets are mine.
Of course. Now you probably assume I brought this meal simply to ambush you about the Fabriel.
You had another purpose, then?
Well, you see, I've heard the most wonderful things about your ward's artistic skill. I thought that maybe...
Of course, Your Majesty. I'd be happy to draw your likeness.
He beamed as she stood, leaving her meal half-eaten and gathering her things. She glanced at Yasna, but the older woman's face was unreadable.
Would you prefer a simple portrait against a white background, or would you prefer a broader perspective, including surroundings?
Perhaps you should wait until the meal is finished, Shallan?
Of course.
No. I'm quite finished. A wider sketch would be perfect, child. How would you like me to sit?
Taravagian slid his chair back, posing and smiling in a grandfatherly way. She blinked, fixing the image in her mind.
That is perfect, Your Majesty. You can return to your meal.
Don't you need me to sit still? I've posed for portraits before.
It's all right.
Very well. I do apologize for making you use me, of all people, as a subject for your art. This face of mine isn't the most impressive one you've depicted, I'm sure.
Nonsense. A face like yours is just what an artist needs.
It is?
Yes.
She cut herself off. She'd been about to quip.
Yes, the skin is enough like parchment to make an ideal canvas.
That handsome nose of yours and wise, furrowed skin, it will be quite striking in the black charcoal.
Oh, well then, proceed. Though I still can't see how you'll work without me holding a pose.
Brightness Shallan has some unique talents.
Shallan began her sketch.
I suppose that she must. I've seen the drawings she did for Varus.
Varus?
The Palinaeum's assistant chief of collections, a distant cousin of mine. He says the staff is quite taken with your young ward. How did you find her?
Unexpectedly, and in need of an education. The artistic skill I cannot claim. It was a pre-existing condition.
Ah, a blessing of the Almighty.
You might say that.
But you would not, I assume?
Shallan drew quickly, establishing the shape of his head. He shuffled uncomfortably.
Is it hard for you, Yasna? Painful, I mean.
Atheism is not a disease, Your Majesty. It's not as if I've caught a foot rash.
Of course not. But isn't it difficult having nothing in which to believe?
I wouldn't say that I have nothing to believe in, Your Majesty. Actually, I have much to believe in. My brother and my uncle, my own abilities, the things I was taught by my parents.
But what is right and wrong? You've... Well, You've discarded that.
Just because I do not accept the teachings of the devotaries does not mean I've discarded a belief in right and wrong.
But the Almighty determines what is right.
Must someone, some unseen thing, declare what is right for it to be right? I believe that my own morality, which answers only to my heart, is more sure and true than the morality of those who do right only because they fear retribution.
But that is the soul of law. If there is no punishment, there can be only chaos.
If there were no law, some men would do as they wish, yes. But isn't it remarkable that, given the chance for personal gain at the cost of others, so many people choose what is right?
Because they fear the Almighty.
No. I think something innate in us understands that seeking the good of society is usually best for the individual as well. Humankind is noble when we give it the chance to be. That nobility is something that exists independent of any God's decree.
I just don't see how anything could be outside God's decrees. Brightness Yasna, I don't mean to argue, but isn't the very definition of the Almighty that all things exist because of him?
If you add one and one, that makes two, does it not?
Well, yes.
No God needs declare it so for it to be true. So, could we not say that mathematics exists outside the Almighty, independent of him?
Perhaps.
Well, I simply claim that morality and human will are independent of him too.
If you say that, then you've removed all purpose for the Almighty's existence.
Indeed.
The balcony fell silent. Yasna's sphere lamps cast a cool, even white light across them. Shallan worked with quick, scraping motions, disturbed by the things that Yasna had said. They made her feel hollow inside. That was partly because the king, for all his affability, was not good at arguing. He was a dear man, but no match for Yasna in a conversation.
Well, I must say that you make your points quite effectively. I don't accept them, though.
My intention is not to convert, Your Majesty. I am content keeping my beliefs to myself, something most of my colleagues in the devotaries have difficulty doing. Shallan, have you finished yet?
Quite nearly, Brightness.
Oh, but it's been barely a few minutes.
She has remarkable skill, Your Majesty, as I believe I mentioned.
Shallan sat back, inspecting her piece. She'd been so focused on the conversation, she just let her hands do the drawing, trusting to her instincts. The sketch depicted the king sitting in his chair with a wise expression, the turret-like balcony walls behind him, the doorway into the balcony was to his right. Yes, it was a good likeness. Not her best work, but... Shallan realized she had drawn something standing in the doorway behind the king. Two tall and willowy creatures with cloaks that split down the front and hung at the sides too stiffly, as if they were made of glass. Above the stiff high collars, where the creatures' heads should be, each had a large floating symbol of twisted design, full of impossible angles and geometries.
Why have I drawn these things? What drove me to...
She snapped her head up. The hallway was empty. The creatures hadn't been part of the memory she'd taken. Her hands had simply drawn them of their own accord.